Well, now it's just like old times for me, as I'm delighted this afternoon to be joined once more by Francis Clamp. It's wonderful to see you again, Francis, and you've just written a book about the county in the war years of 39 to 45, have you not?
I have indeed, and it's lovely to be back again.
So, come on, you've got to tell us all about this book.
Well, the first thing is I was limited to about 40,000 words. Now, that sounds a lot, but once you start writing about something like Essex, it's colossal. So what I've done is I've really followed three strains.
Yeah.
The main events of the war itself. The main event. Sorry, I'm moving away from the lollipop I'm supposed to talk into. I've talked about the war itself and the main facts, how it affected Essex, and very, very important, people's individual memories, because luckily there are people still around who've got those memories.
Now, I'm guessing, but from the synopsis, would I be right in thinking that the subjects covered include the defences planned and implemented before the outbreak of hostilities? And if so, can you give us some examples?
Right. Well, there was something called the General Headquarters Line, and it came into Essex from Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
There were stop lines of defence, but at first it was very difficult because although people had realised war was coming, they hadn't been able to make perhaps as many arrangements as they would have liked to have done. So temporary ditches were dug, some rivers were widened to stop tanks being able to get across. And then later you got pillboxes and those sorts of things. In Essex, we're lucky enough to have six World War II heritage trails. And they were established in various places. One I found absolutely fascinating is at Waltham-on-the-Naze, where they've still got a lot of the old pillboxes falling into disrepair. I mean, there are two of the old gun emplacements that have slipped down the cliffs.
All
and
right.
Now, twice a day, get covered with seawater.
Did the guns much good there?
Well, it wouldn't. Fortunately, they had long gone.
Yeah. I've seen some pillboxes, actually, close to the A130 as you come down from Chelmsford.
You do
Southend.
See them alongside many of the roads, and you think, what are they still doing there?
Yeah.
But, of course, they would cost an awful lot to knock down.
Yes.
Some are being used to store farm equipment, I imagine.
Oh, really?
Things like that. Mm. But most, you can go in and have a look and smell, because there are smells in these places.
Yes, I remember there was one fairly close to where I grew up as a lad, and we used to play on there, but that did not honk inside.
Yes.
Now, you've clearly done a lot of research to unearth, as you said, many personal memories. So how on earth did you set about it?
Well, people are very, very helpful. Anyone of a certain age, I made sure I talked to them, friends, new acquaintances. And very often, it's almost a chain effect. One person talks to you and then says, ah, yes, but who you really need to talk to is, and you get their name and address, and you get them. On one occasion, I was out with my husband on the seawall at Wallasey Island, and we got talking to a couple there, and I do tend to carry a small recorder, because this is invaluable.
And then you find the batteries have gone.
Oh, I make sure I've got spares. But the lady I was talking to had all sorts of memories. Her name's Joan Green, and she lives in Hockley, but she lived close to London. And so, actually, it was on the seawall that I picked up quite a lot of memories. Joan had all sorts of little stories that you don't find in any other books. And this is the thing about talking to people and their own memories. They're unique memories.
Now, I don't know about you, but I find that my memories of past events have often been clouded by the mists of time. So I'm interested to know how you were able to confirm the accuracy of these personal accounts.
Well, first of all, I try to put that it is somebody's memory to cover myself. I research where I can to find out whether this is right. But if it's something, I mean, this particular lady I met on the sea wall.
Yeah.
She told me about her uncle, who went into one of the Anderson shelters and, in the middle of an air raid, got the family in there and then said, I need some more cigarettes. And his wife said, stay here until the air raid's over. No, no, I'll be all right. And he went along to the local shop.
Yes.
And he wasn't all right. You do have notices that say smoking can kill.
Yes.
And unfortunately, this is a story where it really did. Because a bomb fell. And it's stories like that that, you know, you don't come across every day of the week.
Yeah, and I suppose also there were stories that you had different people kind of corroborating what somebody else said.
Definitely. Yeah. Especially when you get people recommending somebody else because they probably went to the same schools and things like that.
Yeah, sure.
You can read around many of these subjects, so you can find out whether that was strictly accurate or not. But they are memories, and obviously there can be some little bits that aren't quite accurate, but I think on a whole the things I included were.
Now, you've touched on air raids, which, of course, were not, although they weren't totally unknown during the First World War, they were much more commonplace in the Second. But would I be right in thinking that these would, for the most part, have affected areas in what I might term metropolitan Essex?
Well, yes and no. Well, Essex, obviously, is on the route back towards the continent. Now, we had to the south, Southend Pier, where there might well be an invasion. This was the big fear in Essex, that there would be an invasion. You'd got over to the east, the Shoeburyness garrison. This was a target. To the north, you'd got a lot of airfields surrounding Essex, and I have dealt with those quite a bit. And you've got London. Now, if any of the planes hadn't dropped all their bombs on the way back, why not drop them off on any buildings you could see? Basildon was a case in point, where you had the Plotlands, and many people moved out of London to go into those little cottages there, and they weren't always safe.
That does surprise me. Yeah, you know, you'd have thought that that those little places wouldn't really have been seen from the air.
Well, they were flying fairly low. And, of course, you had quite a mass of them. And if you've got a few bombs left, why not drop them?
Did you cover in your book anything to do with the forts that subsequently were put off the coast? Shivering Sands and
I have. I think you'll have to read the books to find out about those.
Because they went in later, presumably.
They did.
Yeah.
But yes, there were all sorts of defences of various types put in.
Yes.
They were trying to test to make sure that nothing was actually coming up the Thames.
Yeah.
Because again, if they could get along the Thames, they could get to London.
Of course.
And that could be disastrous,
yes,
to put it mildly.
Now, you've mentioned Anderson shelters. How commonplace would it have been for people to sleep in those? Or would it be a case that as the war went on, a lot of people ignored the threat and choose the comfort of their own beds to the cold and discomfort of the outside shelter?
I certainly think to start with, people were quite enthusiastic about these Anderson shelters. They were down low, so you'd got a permanent smell of earth.
Yes.
And I must admit, when I first went to the secret nuclear bunker, it was that smell that I got. It may have gone by now because it had been closed up for a long time, but it was quite a unique smell that came in school air raid shelters as well. They became damp, and many people very quickly decided that it was better to be indoors. Cupboard under the stairs was a favourite place, because often stairs survived when the house went. They also went under sturdy tables and even put their bedding there. And then later on, there were the Morrison shelters. Now, these were large metal shelters with mesh walls to them. fine, you might be all right if a bomb dropped directly on your house, but if it happened to be an incendiary bomb, I would think you would rather be like a chicken in an oven. Not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
On the other hand, many families spent most of the war sleeping under those shelters. They're claustrophobic.
Yes.
Obviously, it was quite frightening.
Yes.
But you felt they were keeping you safe.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's completely different, but on the one occasion that I personally was in a war zone, it was always the case that it was going to happen to the people next door or somebody next to you, not you. You were always going to be all right.
I think this is true. I mean, they talk about children in war zones. On a whole, children don't think it will ever happen to them.
No, no. I think that's right.
I grew up during this period from being a very small child, and I never thought that this might happen to me.
No, no.
If something happened in the night, you know, it didn't affect you.
Well, it might. Okay. It can't have been easy for housewives, losing their menfolk, looking after the children, dealing with the repairs that husbands who routinely handle, not me, I have to say, I always leave it to my missus, coping with rationing, blackout blinds, illness, and maybe having to take employment themselves. How on earth did they cope?
Well, it's amazing what you can do when you have to. And I think many women decided they'd got talents they didn't know they had. They'd secretly kept them from their husbands.
I believe in letting a show what she could do.
Yes. I think, too, many of the older neighbours who weren't going to war made sure that they came round and checked. There was a gentleman in the road where I lived. He was called Mr. Felsted, and he always used to come round after an air raid to check that the family were all right.
Yeah.
And he doubtless did it to other people in the road. But I think this happened. There were air raid wardens. There were all sorts of people who were willing to help. But women did get on and do all sorts of amazing things.
Now, of course, it's fair to say, is it not, that all these hardships and difficulties would have been faced by people across the country, but I wonder if there's any issues that might have affected people in Essex in a particularly unique way.
Well, obviously, in Essex, they thought that at any moment there could be an invasion. Essex has a very, very large coastline with all the creeks that come in. Mm-hmm. And, of course, creeks would be ideal for sending in small boats.
Yeah.
So there was this constant fear. There were also various large factories. Mm-hmm. We don't always think of Essex as being a place where there are factories. But there was Marconi.
Yeah.
And very close to Marconi, Hoffman's ball bearings.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bombs were dropped, not always accurately, and the houses close by were often wiped out. There was Echo doing all sorts of amazing work. Now, the old Echo site is currently being built over.
It's being redeveloped. I think they're putting a hospice there.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
Certainly, there are lots of houses there, but that was very much a place that could be targeted. And some smaller firms. I mean, there was one called Fritz. And they had, previously to the war, made wrapping papers for sweets, but ideal for making that tic-tac stuff that was dropped from aeroplanes to disrupt radar later on, and that sort of thing. So sometimes it was small factories, sometimes it was large ones.
Now, what about people in coastal areas? Because I'd heard reports that a lot of people were actually moved out. Did this happen widely? And if so, where did they have to go?
Yes. Evacuation happened two ways in Essex. People were sent in and people were sent out. So very early in the war, in 1940, it was decided that particularly places like Southend were vulnerable. They didn't want to blow the pier up because it was too useful for bringing things in and taking people out. So that could have very easily been a place that was an invasion came from. So most of the
make them pay on the train, though.
true. Most of the schools in Southend were evacuated.
Yeah.
And they were sent, a lot of them, north. Mm. But then, on the other hand, London children were coming in.
Right.
And sometimes they almost crossed each other. Brentwood County High School,
yes,
had to take in other schools from London, and so you'd got children being taught in the mornings and children being taught in the afternoons. It's all in the book. So, you know, you have to get the book to read the stories.
But I thought that there were certain places where they actually almost moved everybody out of particular roads, but just at odd houses, that they would leave the same people there. Am I wrong?
Well, you may well be right. That's not something I came across.
Oh, right.
That's one of those stories where, obviously, I didn't get the right person to talk about it.
I could be wrong.
No, you could well be right. Certainly along the cliffs in Southend, they took those over for mainly naval people.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, the fishing boats in Old Lee, presumably a lot of those were used in the Dunkirk evacuation.
They were indeed. Mm. And I've got stories in there.
Ah, there you are. You see, that's one you've got.
So I'm not going to tell you too much about them. But there was one boat from Waterman the Naze, and it was, I think it was the lifeboat that went down. Experts on it, ready to go over to France. Mm. And when they got wherever they were going, they were told, oh, no, we've got the Navy taking these over. Mm. Mm. And they sent these experts who knew what they were doing home again, gave them the tickets for the railway to go back home.
Oh, right.
They were a bit lucky in a way because the person who was put in as captain was actually killed. But that's another part of the story.
And what were the effects of the arrival of the Women's Land Army?
Well, the Women's Land Army was a very, very useful organisation.
Mm.
Obviously, men had been sent away to war. It wasn't always realised that they were necessary to carry on with farming.
Mm.
And these, some from very strange backgrounds, never having anything to do with gardening or any kind of agriculture before, they moved in and they learnt. There was a lot of trouble with people saying, well, should they be trained before they go to the farms, or should they just go in and learn on the job? But actually, they did a fantastic job, although many people rather looked down on the Women's Land Army compared with the uniformed forces, which they regarded as a little bit more upmarket.
Well, if they hadn't have done the job, everybody would have starved.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. And were there any POW camps in Essex?
Yes, there were. Certainly, I've got a couple of stories from Brentwood, where there was one at Worley, and some more were kept at, out along the Ingrave Road, that sort of area. So, yes, there were.
Mm. How was the arrival of US forces greeted by the locals?
With delight. By the young ladies.
I bet it was by them, yeah.
Yes, I mean, they did a fantastic job. They came into the airfields.
Mm.
I spent quite a lot of time when I was doing research at the old Hornchurch airfield.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is now a housing estate. Nearly all the roads are named after officers who were at the airfield. We were there yesterday, and in the cafe, they have a wall where they have photographs and link them to the names of the roads, which is rather nice. But also there, they still have the massing area where they used to go and wait when they were going out. They've got various pillboxes and all sorts of things there. If you wander around, it is well worth visiting because it's now partly a country park.
Good stuff. All right. Now, in your book, do you cover the immediate aftermath of the war?
I've got a chapter that is called Aftermath.
Oh, well, there you are.
It's very difficult to just go in cold because to port 1939 to 45 is very limiting. And obviously, in a way, we're still having the effects of war in some ways. But immediately afterwards, housing crisis. So prefabs were built all over the place. There was worry about health, and you got the beginnings of the National Health Service. Then you had the returning soldiers.
Yes.
And life was
looking for work.
Looking for work.
Yeah.
And so women who'd done jobs very efficiently suddenly found that the men had come back and wanted to take those jobs again.
Yeah.
Yes.
It went down like a lead balloon, I would imagine.
Well, yes, quite. Yeah. So there were a lot of problems. And for men settling down after living in a mostly male environment, it wasn't easy. Some did it very quickly, others didn't.
Well, your book sounds absolutely fantastic, Reed. So please remind us of the title and how and where you can lay your hands on a copy.
Right. It's called Essex at War, 1939 to 1945. You need, actually, the ISBN number if you're going to order a book, which can be ordered through...
Sorry, I'm trying to find a pen.
It can be ordered through Amazon. Most Waterstones have copies.
Right.
And if they have sold out, which I hope they have, you can get them to order more if you have the ISBN number. So pick up a pencil and I'll give it to you now. Scott's already got his in his hand. The ISBN number is 147-386-0415.
I have indeed written that down. Thank you.
Thank you. It costs £12.99 if you buy it in a bookshop.
And?
There are other places.
Okay, fair enough.
I was thinking of Amazon. I don't know what the price is there, but I mean, obviously I'm hoping it will be in the libraries too. But I'm trying... even as we speak, to fix up my first book signing in Brentwood, and then I'm going to move on to as many other Waterstones as I can in Essex.
Well, you'll have to let us know when and where that is.
I will.
Look forward to it. Thanks a lot, Frances.
Thank you very much.